Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Saturday, March 2nd and Sunday, March 3rd, 2024. There's a few anniversaries. On March 2nd, 1962, the Burmese military, led by General Ne Win, overthrew the country's civilian government in a coup. The military stepped in amid widespread public opposition to the government, which was accused of corruption and incompetence, and fears that the government's weakness might cause the country to break apart. This kicked off a period of military, or essentially military, rule in Myanmar that ended... I'm sure it'll end one of these days. On March 2nd, 2002, the U.S. military began Operation Anaconda in Paktia province, the first large-scale battle in the Glorious War in Afghanistan. The battle ended on March 18th with a decisive U.S. coalition victory. It's best not to think about what happened after that. On March 3rd, 1878, the Treaty of San Stefano ended the 1877-1878 Ottoman-Russian War with a decisive Russian victory. The treaty was so lopsided, and in particular the amount of territory given to Bulgaria was so large, that Britain and France stepped in and forced it to be substantially revised at the Congress of Berlin later that summer. And on March 3rd, 1918, the Bolshevik government of Russia signed the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with the Central Powers, marking Russia's formal withdrawal from World War I. In addition to quitting the war, Russia ceded its claims on Belarus, Estonia, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, and Ukraine in Eastern Europe, all of which were expected to come under German domination, and its territories in the Caucasus, which were expected to come under Ottoman domination. Naturally, all of those plans were upset when the Central Powers lost the war. On to the news. The friendly friends of the OPEC Plus group, or some of them anyway, agreed on Sunday to maintain the oil production cuts they instituted last year through at least June. The gang has been restricting production collectively since late 2022 in an effort to keep prices up, but internal disagreements last year prevented further joint reductions, so several countries made their own unilateral cutbacks instead. OPEC Plus heavyweights Saudi Arabia and Russia are continuing those cuts, along with Iraq, Kazakhstan, Kuwait, and the UAE. Global oil prices are fluctuating around $80 per barrel, depending on the index, which is not as high as the group's major players, the Saudis in particular, would like. On to the Middle East. In Israel-Palestine, the Biden administration undertook the first of what I guess will be multiple airdrops of humanitarian aid into Gaza, delivering over 38,000 meals on Saturday. That figure alone shows how ineffectual this effort is. Gaza is home to somewhere between 2.3 and 2.4 million people, all of whom are in some level of food insecurity due to the Israeli military blockade and the inadequacy of current relief operations. According to the United Nations, around one quarter of them, or some 576,000 people, are one step away from famine. Even at 38,000 meals per airdrop, there is no conceivable way to ameliorate those conditions like this. The United States is arming and supporting the Israeli military and has the leverage to force meaningful improvements in aid distribution. The Biden administration is refusing to use any of it. The administration is now targeting the start of Ramadan, which is about 1 week away, for a ceasefire deal, but negotiations appear to take a step back over the weekend. After reportedly agreeing in principle to the ceasefire framework that's currently on the table, the Israeli government boycotted a new round of talks in Cairo on Sunday. It seems Israeli leaders had requested, or have requested, a list of those hostages who are still alive in Gaza, and Hamas is refusing to provide it. It's unclear why Hamas has rejected this request, but aside from creating a new immediate obstacle to this deal, it raises troubling questions about just how many hostages actually are still alive, which could have serious ramifications for the possibility of any ceasefire deal. On the U.S. front, Vice President Kamala Harris issued the Biden administration's most forceful ceasefire demand to date on Sunday. This has generated a bit of buzz, and I'm not entirely sure why. For one thing, it's the VP, not the president, making this call, and it's just rhetorical. There's still no real U.S. weight behind it. For another thing, what she demanded was the temporary ceasefire to which the Israeli government has apparently already agreed. I mentioned this just a minute ago. So she was able to focus her blame on Hamas rather than on Israeli leaders. There wasn't anything new or particularly interesting in her comments, from what I can tell. In Lebanon, the Israeli military, or IDF, killed at least seven Hezbollah members in a pair of strikes on southern Lebanon between Friday night and Saturday morning. Both attacks took place near the Israeli border. In Yemen, the Ruby Mar, the cargo ship that was badly damaged in a Houthi attack last month, has apparently sunk in the Red Sea. It's been spilling oil since the attack, but now its cargo, 22,000 metric tons of fertilizer, is also seeping into the water, and the combined environmental and economic effects may be quite serious. Fertilizer spills have been linked with devastating algae blooms that can create ocean dead zones, and currents may keep that fertilizer trapped in the Red Sea for the foreseeable future, worsening its impact. The extent of the damage may depend on the degree to which the vessel remained intact as it sank, which would determine how quickly the fertilizer gets into the water. The oil may, among other risks, interfere with desalination plants along Saudi Arabia's Red Sea coast. In Iran, Iranian state media has apparently been reporting unofficial results from Friday's parliamentary election that put turnout somewhere in the neighborhood of 41%. That would be the lowest turnout for an election since Iran's 1979 revolution, a bit below the 42.5% who voted in the last parliamentary contest in 2020. And Iranian authorities had to extend voting by 2 hours just to get to that level. Some combination of lingering anger over the Mahsa Amini protests, anger over Iran's weak economy, and resignation at the fact that the outcome was essentially predetermined presumably fueled the apathy. This is presumably something of an embarrassment for an Iranian government that appreciates the PR value of high turnout elections. Interestingly, those state media outlets have been arguing the opposite, saying that the 25 million or so people who did vote represent a rebuke to calls from reformist and moderate corners to boycott the vote. This seems like a somewhat desperate attempt at spin, but what do I know? On to Asia and Pakistan, where the National Assembly elected former Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif to a second term in that job on Sunday. This result was expected, especially after the Assembly elected Sharif's Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz colleague Sardar Ayaz Sadiq as its speaker on Friday. We covered that in Friday's newsletter. Sharif received 201 votes, comfortably above the 169-vote majority line and well ahead of the 92 votes received by Imran Khan's PM candidate Omar Ayyub. In Malaysia, the Malaysian government said on Sunday that it may reopen the search for Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, which disappeared during a scheduled flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing in March 2014 and is believed to have crashed in the southern Indian Ocean well off course. Over the past decade, debris from the aircraft and debris suspected of coming from the aircraft has washed up around the Indian Ocean, but the main wreck has never been discovered. The U.S. firm Ocean Infinity, which previously searched for the wreckage in 2018, has apparently pitched Malaysian officials on another operation. Discovering the wreckage could provide some clues as to what happened to the plane and would also offer some closure to the families of the people who died in the crash. In Africa, in Burkina Faso, a prosecutor in that country's north region revealed on Sunday that some 170 people were killed when three villages there were attacked on February 25th. He's apparently ordered an investigation into the attacks, which he did not attribute to a particular group. That same day also saw suspected jihadist attacks targeting a church in the Sahel region and a mosque in the East region. We covered this on last Sunday and Monday. So interestingly, there were apparently a number of other attacks on that same day, and it's unclear how coordinated these were, but clearly it was a big day for likely jihadist attacks across the country. In South Sudan, that country is supposed to hold a general election later this year that will ideally hasten its political transition out of the instability that marked its civil war. However, a new report from the UN Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan sounds a number of alarms about that prospective vote, and I'm going to read you a bit of an AP report on this. Patterns of violence, violations, and entrenched impunity continue to blight the lives of an extremely vulnerable population, the report said, warning that the already dire humanitarian situation in the country will deteriorate further. The elections, the first since independence from Sudan in 2011, should signify a milestone in efforts to secure a lasting peace since the end of the civil war, which raged in South Sudan from 2013, killing some 400,000 people. A peace deal was agreed in 2018, but implementation has been sluggish and violence persists in parts of the country. The report presented to the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva Friday said the elections face severe political and logistical challenges, and the post-election legal framework remains uncertain. Moving on to Europe and Russia, where security forces killed six militants, put that in quotes because it's not clear who they were, in the Ingushetia Republic or the Ingushetia region over the weekend after gunmen allegedly opened fire on a police facility in the town of Karabulak. It's unclear who the militants were, but Ingushetia, along with neighboring regions Chechnya and Dagestan, has dealt with Islamist violence in the past. In Serbia, officials announced on Sunday that they're redoing December's municipal election in Belgrade, date to be determined. The ruling Serbian Progressive Party officially won that vote, but the Serbia Against Violence Party, with the support of international observers, has alleged that there were major irregularities in the vote and insists it actually won. The SPS rejects those claims, though the decision to do the election over may indicate that there was something to them. In the Americas, in Haiti, gangs attacked that country's national penitentiary in Port-au-Prince late Saturday, killing at least 12 people and freeing around 3,700 of the facility's estimated 3,800 prisoners. There was apparently another attack on a second detention facility, but it's unclear how many prisoners were freed, if any. Notorious gang leader Jimmy Cherizier has been the public face of a major push by criminal groups in the city over the past several days, apparently part of a joint effort aimed at ousting Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry. It's unclear how successful they've been so far, though the prison attack was clearly a significant win for them. And finally, in the United States, the Project on Government Oversight reports on another dismal annual report for, you guessed it, the F-35. I'll read you a bit of this piece, the introduction. The F-35 program officially began on October 26, 2001, when Lockheed Martin received the coveted development contract. That day was more than 22 years ago. The costs of the program through its anticipated lifespan have risen $1.7 trillion since then. What the American people have so far received for that enormous financial commitment is an aircraft program where less than a third of the jets are capable of performing their combat role, according to multiple government sources. The Pentagon's top testing office, the Director of Operational Test and Evaluation, recently released its office's annual report, which showed that the F-35 program has a fleet-wide, full mission-capable rate of only 30%. This year's unclassified version of the report is rather thin. Many details about the F-35's demonstrated performance in 2023 are presumably hidden in the classified version of the report submitted to Congress and the Secretary of Defense. The testing director did say that results from the testing process will be included in the F-35 program's initial operational test and evaluation report, now expected to be released before the end of March 2024. One single detail about the program's abysmal availability rate in the unclassified version of the report says a lot about how poorly the F-35 performs. It doesn't actually matter what kind of dazzling capabilities the F-35 may one day be able to perform. If the aircraft can't be relied upon to perform when needed, then any potential capability is useless. On that note, hope everybody had a good weekend, and thanks for reading and or listening to the newsletter. Thanks to those of you who are Foreign Exchanges subscribers and making this newsletter possible. And until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.